This is MSONewsSports.com. I'm Bill Newell, along with Rick Moore, and we're joined today by State Senator Joan Lovely from Salem. And she, her district serves Beverly, Peabody, Salem, Danvers, and Topsfield. So, Senator Lovely, great to have you back with us.
Thank you. Great to be back.
Well, let's begin. We're going to tick off several issues here that make some sense here, that some of the projects that you're working on. And let's begin with the new public records law. Tell us about that and your role with that.
So the Senate President put me as chair of this conference committee on public records. Both the House and the Senate passed two bills this session, and we got together as a conference committee. And one thing about conference committees is they're usually closed to the public and the press. And actually, we voted to keep this conference committee open because it's public records. So we had all the advocates, all the interested groups, the newspaper, the Mass Municipal Association, the Mass Clerks Association, ACLU, Common Cause. The administration came to the table and helped us peel this bill apart, the old bill, and put it back together and modernize it because it had not been modernized in 40 years. And if you think about it, 40 years ago, we didn't have internet. We didn't have email. So these are the types of things that we needed to modernize. So we took it apart and we put it back together, and we have a really great bill that we think creates more access to public records for anybody who's looking for them at a less lower cost, too.
Any specifics you want to share with us as part of this bill?
So, you know, we actually kept the initial request at 10 business days. So if someone wants to go into their city clerk's office and request a copy of a planning board record that may not already be online, they have the city clerk's office would have 10 business days to produce that. But sometimes some records requests are very large. So we give the opportunity for extensions, an initial extension, and then an extension through the Secretary of State's office if they need more time. We're also trying to cut down on frivolous requests. Sometimes people don't have the best heart when they make a request. So they will request something, give me email for the last 10 years from all of the emails from the police department. That's just too broad. So we ask people to keep it narrowed down. And something that like that would be considered a frivolous request, which it can be denied.
Yeah. How does the internet and emails and all that stuff now, you say, you know, you're modernizing it. So that has made a whole new ballgame for people, because what is public and what isn't?
So this is very interesting. Anything, a public record is produced by a public employee or an elected official. It's at the municipal level, school committees, city councils. I was a city councilor for 15 years. I had to comply with public records. What's very interesting is the legislature has exempted itself. So we actually do not have to comply with public record or open meeting law. Again, I'm trained differently at the local level, and I actually have a policy in my personal Senate office that I will comply with a public records request, except I do have an exception that would be any of my constituent files. If someone's of constituents calling me with a problem, that's confidential and personal in nature, that I just will not release. But anything else that comes through my office, I'm pretty much an open book.
Well, I was wondering about that, because with the internet and so on. But why did the legislature exempt itself?
That's a very good question. That occurred well before I entered the building. Okay. I actually want to work on a bill next session to take a look at that. We actually created a commission out of this public records new bill, and that's to take a look at that as well. So I don't think we should be exempted. Again, confidential files, yes, but a lot of this information should be shared with the public. So we're very excited that we got it done, and it should be much easier to read. One of the things I wanted through this was clarity. Sometimes you read a law, and it can be interpreted 10 different ways. I was looking for the one and only interpretation. So when someone reads it, it's clear. There's lots of clarity with it, and they can understand it and comply.
Well, if we maybe could move on to the you're on the Special Senate Committee on Opioid Addiction, Prevention, Treatment, and Recovery Options, and through that, I know I've talked to a number of legislators this year, and they're most pleased, I think, with the fact that they were able to pass the opioid bill and legislation. So share with us some of your insights on that issue.
This has just been a huge issue. The crisis just continues to grow and grow every single day. We passed a big substance abuse bill last session. We did it again this session under Governor Baker. Really grateful for his support and insight and his working group and what they put together. And so what it comes down to is nobody says they want to grow up to become a drug addict. These are unintentional consequences that people become addicted to drugs and to alcohol. So for the opiates in particular, we've limited the initial opiate prescription to a 7-day supply. There's really no reason if you have your wisdom teeth out, you're walking out with 60 Percocet. And then you take maybe 6 or so, and then the rest of them sit around in a medicine cabinet, and then kids can get into them and experiment, and then they're going down a very slippery slope. We also want to be able to make sure that evaluations, if someone is arriving in a hospital after because of an overdose, that they are being evaluated and that they are being referred right into treatment, that they're not just being reversing that overdose and then they're going out the door back to use again. We also have a provision in there that prescriptions be written in an up to quantity. So say you don't want 21 Percocet for your 7-day supply. Say you only need 10. You can ask the prescriber, I don't need 21, just give me 10. We're trying to find ways to reduce the amount of medications that are getting, you know, into medicine cabinets and frankly out onto the streets. So those are some of the things that we've done. We've increased the number of beds. We've put more financial resources towards that. I just met with a group this morning, a behavioral health group, who said that there's still a shortage of beds. So as much as we are doing, we still need to do more.
Yeah. When I had surgery, I remember getting a prescription. I think it was for oxycodone or something of that nature. And I was given prescription. I came home. And the doctor said, don't be a hero. Take these when you need them. I wish he had said, don't take them unless you need them. He didn't. However, we had the drug disposal program up in Cape Ann a few weeks ago, and so that bottle was on the medicine cabinet. I took it out. It was for 30 oxycodone. So I poured them on the table and counted them. There were 29 left in that pill box. So what it seems like it's a terrific way to start, dealing at the local level. Is there any way that this message can get up to the next level? I know that Chief Campanello in Gloucester was talking about Big Pharma and this whole idea. Is that something that we on the local level should be concerned with?
I think that's definitely part of the conversation, and we should be speaking local, state, and federal level. We should all be partnering on this, about these medications. I heard a statistic, and I'm not going to get it exactly right, but that the United States uses like 90% of prescription medications is used in the whole world. 90% is used by the United States. What does that tell you? And I'm not going to throw prescribers under the bus. They're in the business to keep their patients pain-free. But again, unintended consequences of too many medications out there. Working very closely with the medical universities, with the medical schools, I mean. Mm-hmm. They're working very closely to make sure that they have additional, teaching. Sometimes, medical students aren't getting a whole lot of classroom work on prescribing. So they're making this now a priority, which is just terrific. Again, that's an effort through Governor Baker.
Mm-hmm. Is there any look at how law enforcement agencies are affected by legislation, or are they affected by any of this legislation? Because there's definitely a change in perception now among local police departments.
Well, especially with Narcan. So, those are your first responders. So, again, working very closely with public safety to make sure they have the tools in the toolbox, because they're the ones that are showing up in someone's living room when they've overdosed. So definitely working as a partnership, and Gloucester is doing a tremendous job in this as well, really forefront.
We're talking with Senator Joan Lovely from Salem on a number of different issues and topics that she's been working on legislatively. Senator, is there anything else you want to mention on the opioid issue at this point?
Yes. So we get a lot of calls in my office. You know, one of the number one things we do in the in my office, my State House office, is constituent services. And because I am on the Special Opioid Committee and I am the Vice Chair of the Mental Health and Substance Abuse Committee, we get calls for to help people get into treatment. And so I'm working with a young man now. His mother called me and said that he was in trouble with the law. He was living on the streets. He was actively doing heroin, and she was afraid he was going to die. So he, I said, is there a warrant out for his arrest? And she said, there is. I said, can you find him? Do you know where he is? She goes, I do know where he is. I said, I would suggest that you call the police, have him arrested, and get him into the jail. I said, because the jail has a great detox program now, and it's a diversion program. Instead of going into, you know, being convicted and being incarcerated, mm-hmm. you're actually put into the substance abuse program, because the reason why that young man is on the streets and in trouble is because of his addiction. And addiction is a disease, and we have to recognize it like that. So we're working with the sheriff's department and the courts to help him get into the proper treatment that he needs and get him back on track. I had another woman that I helped last year. Again, she had a warrant out. Her dad had her arrested. And we got her into treatment. We spent a whole day in court with her up in Lawrence, got her into treatment, and I'm happy to say she is healthy, she's clean, she is working, and she's a new mom, and she's doing really well.
You know, some of this kind of parallels, you know, I kind of think of it as kind of the mental health issues as well that the, you know, the state, all states have dealt with, in the sense that if you provide this level of you know, symptoms, then, you know, there's no services for you. But, you know, but in this case, like for this young man, you know, he's committed a crime. He's got to go get arrested, basically, to get help. And in the past, sometimes if you got arrested, then you weren't going to get help either way in these situations.
That's right. And so through Sheriff Cousins' efforts, this pilot program is happening over at the Middleton Jail. And they're actually going to be adding a woman component shortly, probably by the fall. They'll have 20 beds for women, again, to keep to steer them out of incarceration and into treatment. And you know what? We will end up emptying out our jails. The 80%+ people that are in our jails, it's drug-related. And most of those are petty crimes, not the big crimes. We're not talking about the dealers. They belong in jail and prison. These are people that, because they're addicted to drugs, they're committing crimes, and they're ending up in jail. So we've got to reverse that.
Well, let's breeze through a few other topics here as we have time here. And homelessness. Now, there's an issue that's been around forever, and it's still around.
So again, I have to give kudos to the Baker administration. Once they hit office, they really wanted to make this a top priority to actually prevent homelessness before it begins. And what I mean by that is someone might be behind in their rent. They may be behind, they may need fuel assistance. There's some reason why they're going to be out the front door shortly. So we're taking a look at these families and preventing that. We're giving them some assistance where they need it. It's much cheaper to do it that way than it is to put them into a motel at $90 a night. That's almost $3,000 a month for a motel room for family of three, four, five, you know, two beds and a microwave. It doesn't work, and it's very expensive to administer. So we were at a high of over 2,000 families in motels a year and a half ago to under 500 families today. And I'm told by the administration that number will be zero at the end of this year. We were throwing good money after bad. Now we're putting supports in place, and it's cheaper to do.
What kind of supports are those? I mean, maybe you touched on, so I know you did touch on some of that piece, but in other words, that's a big difference, you know, totally in a motel room opposed to not being in a motel room.
So what we're doing is we are putting families into congregate housing, so we're doubling them up in apartments, but we're giving them also intensive case management. Do you have an unemployment issue? Do you have an education issue? Do you need some retraining? What might it be? Do you have a substance abuse problem? What are the issues that are leading you into homelessness? And again, it's cheaper, it's less expensive to provide those supports than just to house people in motel rooms. It's terrible for families. It's very expensive for the state. It's very expensive for the communities that host them over in Danvers. It costs Danvers a lot of out-of-pocket. They have to bus the children that are in school to the community where they were in school, rightfully so. Actually, I'll dovetail on that. I filed a bill this session. We got some funding in it in the budget. I hope it sticks. It's called the Homeworks Program. I sat down with the youth service organizations at the beginning of the session last year, the YMCAs, the Boys and Girls Clubs, and said, how can we get some of these children that are living in motels and shelter into your programs? The problem is the transportation piece. Right. We can't get them home. Moms and dads, their parents don't have cars if they're living in a motel. Most don't. So we've created this program that will help get these kids into after-school programs. They can stay after school. They can do all the sports, homework club, whatever it might be, or they can go to the Y program or the Boys and Girls Club program, and then we're going to get them back to the motel at 6 o'clock, when they go. And they'll have all the same advantages as children that are not homeless. So we think it's a great bill.
A great idea. I'm going to put my tongue firmly in cheek now when I say this, but you're setting a bad precedent and a bad example because you're a Democrat and you're praising a Republican. And with what has gone on in Washington, D.C. this week, maybe they should follow Massachusetts' example.
So Massachusetts is it's a bit unique. You know, we're so heavily Democratic in this state. I don't know if I could get elected if I was a Republican from my district, but I'm a pretty conservative Democrat, fiscally conservative, socially liberal. So I line up with the governor and my Republican colleagues in the Senate quite often, mm-hmm. actually, and it's good. You know, we're really there to do the people's business and not fight over what party we belong to.
Let's talk about national politics, since you were there just, Rick, just a moment ago. But the gun issue, which is just making news all over the place, in Washington, the sit-in in the Capitol this week and so on. Your take on the gun issue, and we had Lori Ehrlich on with us several days ago talking about her legislation. And you know the issues. You know that the terror watch lists, the no-fly lists, the guns, and all of that, and our laws. What's your take on the gun issue?
Well, I agree there should be a no-fly, no-buy legislation. We just have to have that in place. I really don't think it hurts someone's civil rights. If you're on a no-fly list, there's a reason for it. It needs to be investigated and get you off the no-fly list. But if the FBI wants you on a no-fly list, I don't think you should be able to buy a gun. I like Rep. Ehrlich's legislation. I was happy to see Speaker DeLeo pull that. It had gone to study this session, and he pulled it out. And they're going to be taking a look at it. I hope it makes it over to the Senate. I'll absolutely vote for it. I want to give a big shout out to our federal colleagues in Washington, Congresswoman Catherine Clark. I served with her. She had walked out on that moment of silence together with my congressman, Seth Moulton. I think Seth said it right. Assault rifles don't belong on American streets. That doesn't mean to say that I want to take guns away and the right to own a gun. My own son is a lawful gun owner, licensed. He's a reserve police officer, and I want to make sure that those that want to, but it has to be done safely. If you look at other states, Massachusetts, we have some of the toughest gun laws in the nation, and our gun-related violence is around 3% compared to Alaska, which is double digits. And Alaska has very lenient gun laws. So it's just the facts.
Yeah. And doesn't there need to be a discussion not only at the national level but also locally? I mean, I can't talk to my friends I'm former military, but I won't have a gun in my house as long as I have a child in the house. And every time I talk about mass murder, these friends of mine who are gun owners automatically get their hackles up and say, well, you want to take my guns away and you want to rewrite the Constitution. No, I believe in the Second Amendment. But how do we get a discussion, Senator, about this in a sane way so that we can all sort of exchange ideas, whether we're on the left or the right?
I know. So it shouldn't be an us versus them conversation. I think, cooler heads can prevail. We need to come together and just have that conversation. It isn't about trying to take someone's rights away. There are a lot of mental health issues out there. Let's screen for them. Let's, you know what? And you know what? And they're at gun shows. Yes, there has to be background checks. You know, these are just the common sense things that we need to put in place. But let's sit down and talk about it as adults. Mm-hmm. We just can't continue to have innocent people mowed down. I thought for sure after Sandy Hook, this right. conversation was over. I just, you know, how many children were murdered? I just, that doesn't make any sense to me. But we've had several, you know, mass shootings since then, and we'd have to sit down and have a conversation like adults and figure it out.
Well, here's our last topic. Let's talk about the budget. You passed a budget, right?
Yes, we did.
And now it's with the governor, I guess. But I guess there's going to be some more cuts, and so the conference committee or whatever, whomever will have to come back. You guys will all have to come back on the budget. So what's the latest on the state budget?
So the news isn't good. It looks like the FY17 budget, which has not been officially passed yet. So the House did, the governor did his version in January, then the House did theirs in the spring. We did ours in May, the Senate, and now it's in conference committee. But we've had some news that's come out that the revenue projections have not met projections. So we have to take a look at it, and we're told it's going to be anywhere from $500 to $750 million worth of cuts, and that could be painful. We don't know exactly where they're going to come from, but they do have to be done. So we will be working with the governor, with administration and finance to figure that out. I just want the public to know, stay tuned. There could be some cuts coming. It'll be across the board. It's probably going to hurt. But we have to do what we have to do. You can't spend money you don't have. So just bear with us.
The budget debate and discussion was now kind of several months ago, as you point out, or at least a full month and a half ago. But is there any good news in the budget, so to speak, for the cities and towns in a summary? Not this latest news, which is not good news. I get that piece. But any real changes at all in the budget as far as you see it for at least, say, your constituents?
We did increase Chapter 70 money, that's education funding for our schools. We hear a lot from our superintendents, principals, educators that they're asked to do more with less. There's an awful lot of testing going on. I'm not against testing, but when does it become too much? When are you teaching to the test? So we've increased, again, money for Chapter 70. Education is probably the most important thing that we do in this state, to make sure our students are prepared and become, you know, good, productive citizens. And, we've done a lot of good things in the budget to be able to increase resources. You know, you have a finite amount of money. It's a lot of money, $39 billion. It's a lot of money, but it is still finite. We could do more, but I'm not raising my hand to raise taxes. I think we all pay enough taxes, especially locally. If you're a homeowner, real estate taxes have gone up to support local budgets. But we've done a lot of good things.
Yeah. All right, Senator Lovely, good talking with you, and best of luck, and thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Senator Joan Lovely with us. I'm Bill Newell along with Rick Moore on MSO News Sports.com.